welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host. And this evening, Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, is in absentia, but she is very busy doing a very worthy cause this evening, and she may be calling in at some point during the hour, so we will look forward to that at a very important fundraiser in Myrtle Beach. So I am flying the plane solo this evening, so all of you live callers and archive people, please do be patient with me, because I actually have a brand new smartphone, and I am the solo navigator. So anyway, just wanted to give you that little caveat. And I have to say that we have a wonderful guest this evening. Met her a couple of months ago in March at the Q Center for the Missing Conference in Wilmington. And Karen Bowden is our guest, and she was a featured speaker at the Q Center because she happens to know what it's like to be a relative of a person who has become missing, actually raped, abducted, raped, and brutally murdered. And that is just the most horrendous thing that anyone can go through. And Karen has a lot to share with us, and she's definitely paying it forward in memory of her sister, and we certainly have a lot to discuss. So without further ado, Karen, I'd like to say thank you so much for joining me on Shattered Life this evening. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Donna.
Well, you're welcome. In order to best acquaint our audience, if they didn't have a chance to read our posts about what your mission has become, a lot of times it's easier for our audience to perhaps start in the beginning and give a bit of the backdrop in terms of how you began this journey, and to describe your sister prior to this horrendous event.
Okay. Well, my sister Kathy Glotty was murdered in New Hampshire November 21st, 1971. So it's been a long time. She was a very sweet and concerning little girl. She was involved in the community, concerned about recycling, you know, projects, clothing drives, raising funds for, you know, people in need. I often talk about her when I do speaking engagements as, and I know that some people understand this, that she was a young person with an old soul, and that she was very concerned about the Vietnam War, different things like that. Her poetry was very deep. She was a special young girl, and she left our house one night, November 21st, and she went to a little community store. You have to think back in 1971, most people, mm-hmm. It was in Franklin, New Hampshire, most people then didn't lock their doors. Being a child, we walked everywhere. We walked to and from school and to and from the stores because they were, you know, they were close to your homes.
You felt at that time that it was safe, right, you know, to walk
yeah.
in your own neighborhood.
Yeah.
And how old was she at the time, just for our audience?
She was 13. She was 13, and I had just barely turned 15 when uh-huh. she was murdered. Yeah.
Okay.
So, she went down and bought a couple things at the store and then walked to the high school nearby. And I was there that night on a sports banquet because I was a cheerleader. And someone did see her at the high school and kind of look in the window like she was looking for somebody. Maybe she was looking for me. Someone did talk to her. said hi to her, and she didn't respond and walked quickly, across the lawn and actually was headed away from home. And so
was she dressed as if she was just going for a quick errand and to come back home? This is in November, right? So she wouldn't,
yes.
You know, she didn't have a lot of, you know, heavy clothing on, like she was going to go off or whatever?
No, she had her, you know, regular, you know, she didn't have mittens. She had a winter jacket on, and she had a floppy felt kind of hat on that was very popular in the 70s, and she did have snow boots on, but mm-hmm. She didn't have snow pants on, and she didn't bring anything with her. I mean, she didn't bring extra clothes with her, you know, so it wasn't like she was planning on not returning. She just barely had enough money to buy, an ice cream and potato sticks. I don't know if you remember what those are, but those were like her favorite potato sticks. Yeah,
right.
And so she had bought those two things that night, and then she never came home. And I came home from the sports banquet and finished babysitting for a couple little boys that I babysat for across the street from us. And my sister Janet was taking care of them until I got home, and that's when I found out that she didn't return home from the store. And my mom, I could tell my mom was very concerned because it wasn't like her not to be home, you know, about that time at night. And so I finished babysitting and then went back home again at 11:30, and she still wasn't home. And that's when I remember walking in and seeing my mom very concerned, and she just said, "Something terrible has happened. I just know it."
Now, in the beginning there, then, when you didn't hear after a few hours and you called your mom and dad called the local law enforcement, right? What was the initial response?
Well, the initial response was, not really concerned. One of the things that was said to us was, you know, kids run away all the time. She'll probably be home later. That it wasn't too concerned. They did send out up to the state police later and to the local police in the surrounding areas and gave a description. And basically my mom was told that, you know, we'll go out and we'll drive, you know, we'll ride around on the streets and we'll see if we see her, but there's not much that we can do until, you know, she's been missing for a certain amount of time. And but even the next day when she didn't return home all night, we knew something was very wrong, and we knew her to not be like that and not call or anything like that. So, you know, the next day when we went, my sister Janet and I actually went to talk to the police, and I remember being laughed at by law enforcement and just said, you're silly. It's probably just a runaway, and she'll come home because she'll realize that, you know, it's not very good out there and she doesn't have money and all that stuff. She'll come home. And so actually my sister Janet and I and even some friends in the neighborhood were the ones that started looking for her. We went to her school and asked if we could talk to some of her friends, different things like that. So
more vigorously than the police at that point, right?
Yeah, at that point I felt so. I felt we were very concerned and they were just, kind of taking a laid back. We'll take care of it. We'll look.
Yeah,
but I don't think you should worry, I don't think you should worry that much about it.
Karen, at that time in the early 70s, did they have that missing 72 hours kind of a benchmark that is incorrect, especially nowadays?
They had to wait a certain amount of time. And I believed it was 24 hours, but it could have been longer than that. But they did. It wasn't like they could really get involved in an investigation until she had been missing for a certain amount of time. And you know what can happen in that amount of time, especially if she's still in the area. But it was very hard because we didn't feel that we got cooperation at that time from the police. And she was, I even remember that afternoon, she still wasn't found. And I remember going down, we had railroad tracks near our home. I remember walking those railroad tracks thinking, well, maybe she had walked that way to the store or something. And if there was something I could see that was hers, and I remember walking that railroad tracks, and that was when, after I had done that, I headed home, and which was just right up the road, and I headed home and went inside, and that's when there were police there, and my mom was hysterical, and my sister Janet was crying, my dad was crying, and my grandmother was there, and I just remember walking in and just looking at them and saying, you know, what's the matter? And my sister Janet was the one that told me that Kathy had been murdered. And, you know, at first you're like, no, you know, that
can't be.
There's no way. That can't be true. You know, it must be someone else, or, you know, that doesn't happen in our little town. And so it was very, I didn't even know how to, you know, grasp it and even believe it. You know, but once I saw her, I looked at her eyes and her face, and I knew, you know, what she was telling me was true. And just at that time, I remember the doctor giving my mom a shot of something to basically put her out because she was hysterical, you know. So.
Did they describe any of the details or ask somebody to come to the scene, or was it at that time like a coroner's office that someone had to go and identify her?
There was someone that actually that was an immediate family member that identified her, and we didn't really have a coroner in New Hampshire at the time. There was actually someone that was brought in that did the autopsy from Massachusetts at that time. There was a pre-autopsy done by a Dr. Beaudry, but. The main autopsy was done by a man from Massachusetts. And
what were the circumstances with regard to where and how she was found?
Well, at first we didn't, you know, it's like you find out that she's been murdered, but you don't know any details, and they don't really want to give you any details, you know, because it's an investigation. But, you know, lo and behold, the media always has a way of finding out things that normally we can't find out. And sometimes that can be a good thing, sometimes not. But so it was the media that's where we got a lot of our information was from, you know, WMUR was the TV station that did most of the coverage on it. And then, you know, the newspapers were big, and, you know, so a lot of the things that we found out were through them and not through law enforcement, and it just trickled in. Like, you know, you see newspaper articles, and the headline is, like, Franklin girl was beaten to death, says Rudman. You know, Rudman was the attorney general back then. You know, and then all of a sudden you see Franklin girl 13 beaten to death, Franklin girl molested and slain, and also.
And that's how you found out those details with those sensational headlines?
Yeah, that, you know, so that's really how we found out. It was very, back then, the relationship, and I think it's better now, but there's still a lot of work to be done. But the relationship between a family and law enforcement, because we didn't have victims' rights advocates, you know, and we didn't have all the programs that we have now. We didn't have any of that back then. So there was no one to buffer for us. You know, it was, and law enforcement in 1971, you know, basically we were told not to talk to each other about it, not to talk to anyone else about it, and so you were dealing with this on your own. And So all of these things that were coming out, we were learning through the media. Like, we didn't know, at first we didn't know that, we knew she had been murdered. It was through the media that we had found out that she had been raped. It was through the media that we found out that she was found naked, except for her knee-high socks. It was through the media that we found out that she had been run over. They believe that the perpetrator, the killer, ran over her body after he dumped her in the woods. All of those things came out. And that she was beaten, not just raped, but she was beaten, and she was strangled on top of all of that. And the
overkill. And did they
exactly
have, so the newspapers had free rein to say anything they wanted because of freedom of the press, and the police didn't say, well, you know, let's withhold some of this until we do more investigation or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know how they got their information, because even in 1971, the local law enforcement in Franklin, you know, they were working the case, but then the state police came in and was working the case, and the sheriff's department was working the case. So you had all these different departments working the case, and it was very sad back then, because they all were digging in their heels, and nobody would share information because they wanted to be the one that would solve the case. And that goes right up to the attorney general. You know, there were remarks by the attorney general that Franklin law enforcement was not to speak to anybody. You know, everything had to go through him. Every single thing had to go through him. He wanted to know everything, every detail about this case. And nobody was to do anything on this case unless he knew about it and he approved it.
Right.
And that really, that slowed the case down. And
sure.
And then people not sharing information, that was, you know, just because, I don't even understand that, because, you know, anyone that is involved in a murder investigation, no matter where you get your information, you should all come together and work together, because
I
the family, you know, they don't care who solves it. They just want
justice. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever shared with you, but we learned with my dad's homicide through a newspaper article that morning, and had to call the Hartford police to ask if it was actually him in the article, and they put their hand over the phone and said they just identified him. So we had a horrendous time with regard to that too, Karen. So, you know, the way that the information gets put out there or withheld, and who tells you what, is makes all the difference in terms of, you know, your memories and how that's burned into your brain for the rest of your life, and how you ultimately go forward and are going to deal with it, you know. But I just think that there, at least today, I think there's a much better protocol with respect to, you know, how things should be done, and with the advent of victim advocates and cold case units and everything, there's a lot more than, and our homicide happened 10 years after Kathy's in 81, and we just had a 33-year anniversary. All this stuff is so very important, and what was the main impetus for you to maybe write the book? When did you start thinking about writing the book? Let's talk about that a little bit. You know, A Child is Missing. At what point in the time did you think about that?
Well, I started to think about, I had thought about it for years, but I just didn't feel that I was capable of doing, you know, such a thing. And I didn't think anybody would ever want to publish it. And so I really hindered myself from doing it. And it wasn't until 2004, and I was facing something very traumatic in my life, and I needed to direct my path on something that was going to take my mind off it, and that had purpose and had would help people. And so I decided to write, and I literally had to go and buy a computer, a laptop. I had to teach myself Word. I had to learn how to, do pictures and all of those things. So it wasn't just writing a book. It was learning all these other things. And my daughter, mm-hmm. Jocelyn, who is the oldest in the family, she really helped me a lot. And, you know, we had times we laughed, we had times we cried, we had times where I thought we were just going to kill each other, you know, but she took time to help me and understand how to do pictures and different things like that. But so I just started writing, and she is the one that actually, you know, said, Mom, you know, you don't have to have the book finished. Why don't you send in the 6 chapters that you have done and send it into this company and see what they say? And I thought, well, you know what? I don't care if anyone wants to print it. It doesn't matter to me. I'm going to do this for myself because I never really got to grieve the way I needed to when I was a child. And
so it was very therapeutic for you once you started, is that right?
Pardon me?
It was very therapeutic for you once you started?
Yes, and it was. And that's the way I looked at it. You know, I just thought, I'm going to go through step by step what I remember, and I think this is going to really help me. And it did. It was very, you know, I remember sitting there sometimes writing, and I would make myself get out of the house sometimes and write because I just would feel, you know, like I was in a cave. And sometimes I'd go to, like, you know, a bookstore, Barnes & Noble or something, and I'd sit down and I'd start writing, and I would be so intense and involved in what I was writing, I'd actually forget that I was there. And it wasn't until someone made like a loud noise, or I'd have tears streaming down my face because I was in a part where I was talking about the suffering that my parents went through. And so, you know, I sent it in and I didn't hear anything for months, and I thought, well, they're not interested, but you know what? That's okay. I'm going to do this anyway. And I just kept writing. Right. And then it was probably four months into it. A month into it, they sent me a letter and said that they were interested. And then I never heard anything from them. And 4 months later, all of a sudden, it was a very low day for me dealing with another trial in my life. And I was, you know, very upset. And all of a sudden, I got this FedEx thing, and I thought, what is this? And I opened it up, and it was a contract for the book. And I bawled for the longest time because I couldn't believe that somebody wanted to print what I had written. And then I let the contract sit there for 3 weeks because I was afraid that once I signed it, I knew I had to finish it. And I was afraid that I couldn't do it, you know? And,
How far had you gone then at that point? Were you like 3/4 of the way through?
Pardon me?
Were you like 3/4 of the way through at that point when you
point, I wasn't even halfway through.
Oh.
Yeah, I wasn't even halfway through. And so they accepted it. And with the contract, you have 1 year. You know, I had 1 year to finish it and get it in. And so that's what I worked on. And then, you know, I think people have when you go and you look at a book in a bookstore, you know, you really don't think about the person that writes it and how much work goes into it and everything.
Oh, the blood, sweat, and tears. Oh, really?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. It's just amazing. You know, I mean, you write this book, and when I was finished, I had a goal to finish New Year's Day, and I finished it and I sent it to them, and then the editing process starts. And it's just amazing what you go through, just the editing process. It took a little over a year to go through the whole editing process to rewrite, you know, subtract, take things out, put things in, rewrite. You have to be willing to do a lot of work. And so I went through that whole process once, and then they send it back to you, and I went through the whole process twice, and then they told me that it was ready for print. And then I said, are you sure? Maybe we should do it one more time. And
from the publisher's perspective, Karen, what did they say? I'm going to play the devil's advocate here. Okay, this is about a person that has gone missing. There's tons of people that go missing. What is it that kind of rose above all the rest to say, this is very compelling and we want to publish this because? What did they say? Because we have a lot of listeners that are would-be authors, well, including myself and authors mm-hmm. from our company and whatnot. So I think they'd be interested in that kind of nugget of information.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing I received from someone that's way up in this company, mm-hmm. she said to me that the book was very compelling because I was very detailed, and I didn't tell them right away that it was my sister I was writing about. I just sent it in. They didn't know it was my sister. And she said, I don't know if you're writing this about someone that you know or if this is someone in your family or if this is fiction. And she said, mm-hmm. but you are very detailed, and the emotion that comes through of what, mm-hmm. you know, you understand, the emotion that comes through is just incredible. And she said it just, you know, other people that had started reading it had them in tears, you know, just going through the process. Because, you know, once it gets in there, just one person that looks at it and they're like, no, that goes in the no pile. You know, and
right.
this goes in the yes
right.
pile, then it goes to the next step up and on, you know. But I think
you need
to be detailed and you need to be willing to really just open
bear
up
your
with
soul
every single
too, right?
emotion that you have. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you can tell by writing, you know, some people may write mysteries or have a ghostwriter, but you can tell when it's the genuine article, those of us that have gone
right.
through it. And so I think that's what people, the comments that I read, the reviews that I saw, and even comments today from our post were like, yeah, she had me in tears, you know, from not from the word mm-hmm. hello, but basically from the very beginning. So I have to congratulate you for, you know, for really grabbing the readers in the very beginning, and that's what's so important,
yeah.
you know? And
I one of the things I do because I'm this type of reader is I hate long chapters.
Uh-huh.
I like
Me too.
Short chapters.
Okay.
You know, there's and so
seems like you're making progress, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I like to finish a chapter, and if a chapter's like forever long, it drives me crazy. So I purposely
yes.
made chapters, you know, very short. And
mm-hmm.
You know, I think another thing is too that you just have to be willing to really open up. And when I questioned them about editing it a third time, you know, I said, "Are you sure?"
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, I can read it now and I'll see little things that, oh, you know, whatever. But
yeah.
they said, no, Karen, because sometimes the book is actually overcorrected. And when it is, it's not you anymore. So
okay.
I have to give kudos to Tate Publishing for understanding that and letting
mm-hmm.
it be, you know, letting
what
it be
it
me, because they do not do ghostwriting. And that's why I went with them, because they purposely, whatever was mine is mine. And if they
right.
suggested changes, I had to make the changes and I had to agree with it. They did not make
right.
the changes
your
they
word.
Weren't allowed to.
Not theirs. Yeah, well, that's so important. I think that's very good insight for the audience in terms of people who are in the process of writing, and we know authors that are working on things or people that are just
mm-hmm.
embarking on that. So that I think that is really good. And, you know, a half hour's gone by already. Can you believe it?
Oh, my word. Well, one
yes,
of the things,
yes.
too, I want people to understand about the book, it's not, you know, I've had some people that are, they're avid readers about murder, you know,
true
murders
crime.
And stuff, but in crimes and stuff, but and they want, like, the gory details. You
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying? You know, they really like to get
right.
in there and hear the gory details. And
yes.
Yeah, exactly. And my book is not like that. And so some people, they might be, oh, I read murder stories all the time. And, you know, that one might not, mine might not interest them because it's not written that way. It's the emotional challenge,
how the family
from a child.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
And the family dynamics and everything. And, you know, that's what I wanted people to understand. Now, the second one, I wish I could have put everything in one book, but I couldn't because we were filming with 2020. We were fighting for the cold case unit in New Hampshire. We were doing all kinds of things. And so I had to end the book because of my contract. And I'm glad that I did, because the sequel that I'm working on right now is going to be A Child is Missing, Searching for Justice. And I started out looking to do like 4 interviews, maybe a little bit of research to kind of get a little bit more into what actually happened and the crime and the people that worked on her case and stuff. And what ended up being that ended up being over 50 interviews and over 6 years of research. And so the second book is going to be very different from the first one. And it will have, I have had some good men and women that have worked on Kathy's case that have opened up to me and revealed how difficult it was to work on her case and have been very, very kind to me. And I'm thankful for that. And so that there's going to be new information that nobody knows about that's going to be coming out in that book.
Well, that's a cliffhanger. That's very good. And, Didn't you say that that you wanted, or you felt that the first book here is actually can be a teaching tool with respect to, now you're saying with with respect to the emotional aspect and the family dynamics and all of that, you want people to buy it with that in mind, whether it be families or sponsor this.
I've had law enforcement that have bought it and used it as a teaching tool. I've had victims advocates that have bought it, because it gets into the mind of what I was thinking and how I tried to deal with in a situation like that, and the different games that I played in my mind to try to cope with the pain, and a lot of different things, and the dynamics of the family when your parents check out, because they can't deal with the suffering, and you're still at home, and you're still, I'm still alive, and there's
survivor's
a lot
guilt.
Of things that
survivor's
I touch
guilt.
On about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
I think one of the things that was just touched my heart, and when I read it in an email, I broke down and cried, was someone who's a supervisor in Ohio for the BCI, because they've had me come out and speak. I did 4 sessions out there because the governor out there had a unsolved homicide initiative pushing for more to be done on unsolved cases. And I spoke for all 4 of them, and one of them, the supervisors, came up to me and he said, "Karen, I read your book and it really touched my heart." And he said, "Especially the part about how you describe when law enforcement comes in and tears the room that you shared with your sister, tears that room apart and her things and opens up her mattress and all the things that they did, and then they left it exactly what they had done to it. And you standing there and looking at it and just thinking, this is all I have left of her. And you've just torn it all apart."
It's such a violation of privacy. Yeah.
Yeah,
so that
and
really
he said that touched his heart so much because he said, "I've done that because I figure it's my job." And he said, "And I've done that before and not thought of it." And he said, "But recently we went to a homicide and I had to go into someone's bedroom and I made sure that everything was put back the way that it was. And it was because of your book."
That's great.
So that
to hear
just really,
that's like golden. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I speak to that. My passion is law enforcement. I help families how to get in contact with media, what they can do to try to bring interest to their cold cases. But, I have a passion to work with law enforcement to make them understand, what we've been through. And my PowerPoint I use with them is very powerful, very emotional, And usually they look like deer in, you know, in the headlights when I'm done.
Right.
Because they're just, you know, it's things that they don't think about. And that's what I'm trying to do is to create, you know, them, you know, thinking about these things and everything they do, everything they say and how it affects a family, you know, and how they
because
wait.
Right, because they're supposed to
you know,
be objective
one thing.
And this is a job, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. And they're and the family is, you know, Kathy's case, she was murdered in 71, but her case was reactivated in 83, so we went through it all again in 83.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was reactivated in 2004, so we went through all of it again. And then
again,
the remains
right.
were exhumed in 2006. And then there was new information that came in, you know, because of that. And, you know, so all of these times, the only time we had a victim's advocate was in 2006 when they talked to us about some new information and they wanted to exhume her remains. And so Jen Hunt was our victim's advocate, and she told us what she could do for us. But seriously, I just looked at her and I said, I don't know what to do with you. Because we've been on our own so long.
You had more experience than she did. Yes, I know.
I was just like, so we didn't really even use her, even though we were finally given a victim's advocate.
Assigned,
but I just didn't know how to function
her.
With one.
Oh, yeah, this new person. Yeah, you had so much expertise, you know, by trial and error. And, hey, do you want to tell them a couple things I'd like to talk about, you know, in the next 22 minutes are the fact that, you know, the evolution of cold case units, of which you've been very influential, the DNA law that you helped to place and all of that you are making a mark, a niche mark in a certain aspect of what happens in all of our lives, and you know, just want to make sure that we cover some of those things because I think it's very important, you know.
Well, you
so
know, it's definitely a joint effort when you do any of these things, you know. And in 2009. There was a retired detective, Mr. Horak, that really wanted to have a cold case unit in New Hampshire, and he approached a representative, and they got things going, trying to create a law for a cold case unit in New Hampshire. And so they got things going, and then, of course, because we were so in the media at the time, we were able to bring a lot of the media attention in because they were ready to vote it down in New Hampshire and not have a cold case unit because, you know, families need to understand that law enforcement works within economics and what money is available always. And also politics come into play. And that's
right.
like another whole story. But you know that all of those things come into play when, you know, cases are worked and such. So, you know, this had started, so we brought a lot of media attention and put a lot of pressure on them. And my sister Ann and Janet, my sister Janet and I spoke before the Senate, and we lobbied for the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit. And you know how that goes. You could be the last one to speak that day, and they're half asleep by the time you get to them.
Yeah,
you know?
You wait
and,
8 hours.
Right? Yeah, and there were actually two that were dozing off. And when my sister Ann got up there, she said, very loudly, she said, I want you to put all your papers down. And I want you to look me in the – and it startled them. And she said, I want you to look me right in the eye. And you know you have to be that way. You know, you have
of
to –
Of course.
You have to, you know, kind of give a presence of command. You know, I need you to listen to me. This is important. And so we brought a lot of media attention to it, and they ended up – voting and passing the law and the bill and making it law. And we were there when Governor Lynch signed it into law. And they've had great success, you know, since late 2009. They just barely got together. And, you know, they've had seven cases that they've solved. Some are waiting trial. Some are that the DNA finally matched and they knew who the the murderer was, and they were able to finally take it off the books. And that means
because
everything to a family, too. Yeah, you know, it's like they're still waiting for answers. But if you could just tell me, okay, so-and-so, this is his DNA, and now we know he's the one that murdered your loved one, you know, we can close this now. We can take this off the books. Well, I would love that.
Sure.
I would love that for me, you know. And so it's important for them to work these cases.
What's the status of the, because we didn't get to that earlier, of the potential suspect's perpetrator and, you know, the person they looked at was Edward Earl Duquette, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And a strong suspect?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What's the status
of
that?
They believe, you know, they believe that he was involved in it and that he was, you know, he was involved in it. But I still believe that the person that actually killed Kathy is still alive today. And some of the things that will come out in the next book will, there's going to be some things that really, you'll almost sit back and you'll say, how could they not have made an arrest in 1971?
Mm-hmm.
And if not in 71, how could they not have made an arrest in 83? Because in 83, there was a grand jury, but they ended up, they didn't indict him. But there were several men that would not, you know, turn over and give information when they were called to the grand jury. And it should have been at least been done then. And then after 1983, as years went on, it just got more and more difficult. But in 1983, they thought they were very close, you know, to making an arrest. And they even told us in 1983, you know, we're this close. And when I talked to a retired law enforcement officer that worked her case in 1983, he said, Karen, we were very close. But what I was told by the Attorney General was we're not spending $250,000 on a case unless it's a slam dunk. And that's the word that he used. They wanted a slam dunk. They didn't want a chance that it was not going to, you know, that the person wasn't going to be convicted. They weren't willing to spend the money on the case unless they were absolutely sure that this guy was going to go to jail. And so, you know, that's why I talk about, you know, politics and, you know, things, economics,
and
you know, that kind of makes a decision sometimes.
That's probably a drop in the bucket now compared to what the trials cost now in 2014, right?
it's like it's over $1 million,
right,
you know,
million.
To go to trial now. It's ridiculous.
That would have been Trump change, you know. Yeah, we'll get to that. And what do you think with regard to having the ability to establish more cold case units? And I understand there might be one person in a cold case unit, depending on the jurisdiction, how large or how small.
Mm-hmm.
But are these really spurring interest across the country? And as they're getting more successful, do you think, by and large, that more homicides are being solved because of cold case units in combination with technology?
Yeah, I think that it is very promising, and I do think that states are beginning to see, you know, having, and of course you're dealing with economics again, but having a unit, not just one man, but I've done a lot of work with Ohio. Ohio would love to have a cold case unit. That would be their job. That's all they do. They're not called out on the field because, you know, homicide units, they may pick up a cold case and they look at it, but then they're called out on the field. And sometimes it can be months, even a year, before they even look at it again. And then it's almost like they have to start over again. So there's no consistency. Mm-hmm. So a cold case unit, that's their job. That's all they do. And if anyone understands solving a cold case, you know that it's a murder that's just happened is reactive, but a cold case is proactive. And there's
mm-hmm.
all kinds of research that needs to be done, you know, who's
mm-hmm.
still alive, who's the victim, you know, the witnesses, are they still around, where do they live, what are the family dynamics? Some people might not even be talking to each other in a family when they were close, you know, way back. There's so many things that are involved, traveling and all of that stuff. But I think a unit, when they get together and they work these cold cases, they can have great results. And I do believe that it needs to be a unit. You know, one, it's a lot for one man to take on, that if there was a unit, that there would be better results. You know, I mean, just give, these are some statistics from 1980 to 2008. I can't even find recent, you know, stats on this. But in Connecticut, from 1980 to 2008, you have over 1,000 unsolved murders.
Right.
If,
we have
if
a
you
cold
go
case
to,
like that,
yes. Yes. You know, if you go to, you know, Texas, they have over 15,000. You go to California, they have over 30,000 unsolved.
Incredible.
So these are, you know, these are people, and it's just incredible that these people can get away with this all their lives and end up having families or, you know, whatever, and there's no justice for the person that they murdered. And now with all the technology we have, we've got touch DNA. You talked about the DNA law, which, you know, we supported that, but there was a mom, Karen. Her name was Karen. She you know, went from state to state and fought for the cold case unit. I mean, for the DNA law, and actually her daughter, there's a man in prison right now because of the DNA law, and because New Hampshire, you know, took in the DNA law, and this man committed a felony, and they swabbed him from DNA, and it was a robbery, and swabbed him from DNA, and 15 years ago, Karen's daughter was murdered, and it was an exact match to the DNA that was left on her daughter, and this man went to trial, and he's in prison right now. So there's so many new things, you know, touch DNA and all of those things that can be used. And so if we have the people that can work these cases, I really believe some people might not think since, you know, getting together since 2009 that seven cases in New Hampshire have been solved. If you understand,
it is a lot.
It's a lot. It's a great outcome. And to tell you the truth, I mean, I don't know if this happens to you, but because of I put myself in the public and I fight for cold case units. And, you know, I also really encourage every state to have a website that lists every unsolved and missing, you know, on a website so that police officers through the whole state can see and understand how many are unsolved, but also they can share information. People can leave anonymous tips, you know, and, you know, New Hampshire never had a website until the cold case unit was formed. That's when they created the website. And there were three murders that were not put on, and there's not a lot in New Hampshire, and there were 30 murders that were not put on there that were overlooked in the and the family was the one that contacted them and said, my son or daughter or so-and-so was murdered. Why is she not on this list? And they did research, and they said, yeah, you know, they should be on there. So these websites are really important, too.
It is. Do you think it comes down to, in terms of forming them, like the three elements I can think of, it's, okay, do we have enough money to start a unit? Do we have sufficient investigators with enough experience, and is our attorney general amenable to doing this? Are there other factors involved in starting one of these?
I think there is. I think the attorney general, if it starts from the top and they have a great desire, I know working with Ohio that the governor and the attorney general, they have a great desire for Ohio to have a cold case unit. And so it's got, you know, the enthusiasm has to start from the top. And, you know, New Hampshire Cold Case Unit, they started with a three-year grant. It was a government grant. And then after 3 years, they needed to take them on as a unit. And that was another battle. You know, they almost were dissolved. after the 3 years because the state was like,
really?
We don't have the money to take them on and everything. But
mm-hmm.
eventually what happened was the state police, they're under the state police now as a unit. And usually once that happens and they're taken under a unit, then it's they're not easily going to say, you know, oh, we're not going to have a cold case unit anymore.
We're
going to
dissolve it, yeah.
Exactly. That's not what happens. So I have, you know, I really have to give New Hampshire, you know, thumbs up for that and for a lot of the domestic violence, you know, laws that they're passing and, you know, that a state, they have to be so active and even us as individuals, you know, there's so many things that we can do. I mean, New Hampshire just passed Joshua's Law, you know, and that was a murder-suicide. And her, you know, Joshua's mom fought for Joshua's Law. And, you know, it's usually the people that have experienced these things that put their hearts out there and you know, face the media to make changes in laws and so that it can be better for somebody else. And there's so many warriors that are out there that do these types of things. But I definitely believe that, you know, the attorney general and the governor of a state, you know, they need to be on board for these kinds of things to happen. They need to see how important it is to
and
have a cold
case unit. And they need a concerted effort by families of homicides to push for this and to say, yes, this
mm-hmm.
is needed. And you know, because it's like... you know, you don't want to be in a vacuum when you're advocating for these. And if and it's so good that other families called them and said, hey, our family should be part of this. Do you know about this?
Mm-hmm.
And then you think of the wonderful nonprofits like The Lost and Missing with Cynthia Karen,
mm-hmm.
the, you know, the Q Center for the Missing with Monica Kayson. There's so many
yeah.
good grassroots organizations out there that are doing so much to help and without any money whatsoever. So I
exactly.
don't think we can ever use the excuse that we don't have money. Right, Karen?
Right. I agree. I think, you know, even you understand what you do and I understand what I do. And most of what I do is I pay for everything. You know,
mm-hmm.
Right. I don't charge people for my speaking engagements. I rarely, you know, ask for any kind of, you know, if I can, I try not to ask for traveling expenses. And then if I do, if I'm able to sell my book or sell, you know, the Victims of Violent Crimes bracelet, you know, which I developed in honor of Kathy, if I'm able to sell these things, many times I give 50% of the profits to the organization. So I'm always trying to give back. So, you know, it's not a situation where, you know, oh, you know, I'm going to make all kinds of money from, you know,
no.
I'm going to make tons of money from a book or whatever and stuff. That's not what I did it for. And it's, and
no,
I always want to give back. And there are so many things and families, you know, that are willing to support these kinds of organizations. And I would love to have a booklet made up that has these organizations in it and a small description of each one and what they do, because for me as an individual, when I was asked to come out and speak for the Q Center for the 10th annual, you know, the National Conference for Missing Persons, I didn't know anything about them, and so I did research on them before I got there. And then speaking to this group of people that were, there was over 300 people there, speaking to this group of people and knowing that I was speaking to people that know exactly what I mean, know exactly what I'm talking about, and have gone through, you know, suffering. We've, you know, we've all gone through different phases of it and handled it different ways, but I had such connection, you know, with those people
personal
there
connection,
that I
yes.
never had before
really?
With
really?
A group of people. No, because
mm-hmm.
I'm always, you know, I grew up, you know, doing everything myself and not
mm-hmm.
relying on any of these groups. So it's almost like I don't even know how to. You know, and so when I was there and saw these people that are willing to help and do whatever they can, even though they're still looking for their loved one, but they want help to look for someone else's loved one. And the compassion that they have, I've not ever experienced that. And so, you know, when I wrote the blog, I told people I truly did receive more than I gave when I went there.
Well, I think so, too. And I've been there for 3 years, and I've become a State of Connecticut coordinator, very, very proudly so. And, you know, it's not about money with any of these things. And with we have about almost 5 minutes or 4 minutes left. And what I wanted to ask you, now, you actually right now live in Arizona, correct?
I do. I moved from Ohio. I was in Ohio for about six years. Really got involved and got established there. I did some work with CASA and such. One of the things I want people to understand is that I know that law enforcement can screw up. I've experienced that in my life. In Kathy's investigation in 1971, we had law enforcement. There was corruption. There was someone in law enforcement leaking information to the prime suspect at that time. And so I understand, you know, that they don't always do everything right. And that's one of the things that I try to explain to families, too, that
non-human.
But that's, you know, they're the people that we count on to solve these cases. And so we expect them to be almost like a god and never make a mistake, and that's just not reality. Now, I don't tolerate sloppy work, but I'm just saying that there's probably not a case out there that there hasn't been one mistake made, that they should have done it a different way.
There were
so
many in ours, but we have to educate them, too, and that's what you're doing about the whole other side of the coin that they really don't realize, you know, just by your illuminating example about your sister's bedroom, and that kind of just opened the window for that one officer. Just to have those kind of examples is very illuminating. And so you have to educate them, and it can only be better with all of us trying, you know.
Everybody has something that they can do, and you'll know the right time. You know, look how long it took me. It took me a long time, but you'll know when you're ready to do it. But there's always something somebody can do, and you'll find out what your passion is. I believe that when you start doing some of these things, there'll be something that will be really a passion of yours and really, be on your heart that this is what you really want to do.
And
I think it takes everybody.
It is. And with God's help, I know that's important in your equation. Can you kindly give us some contact information with regard to if you'd like people to get in touch with you as a consultant and about your book and, you know, how they can order it, that kind of thing, because we have like 1 minute left.
Okay.
So I'd love to have that, okay?
Well, you can go on my website for the book is www.karenboden.com, and that's my book
website.
And
how do you spell your last name?
It's B-E-A-U.
Yep.
D as in dog, I-N. And you can go on there, and from there you actually can go to my WordPress site. And my WordPress site is like what you do. I blog about different things that are going on, any new information and things like that. And also you can look at the bracelet that I created, the Victims of Violent Crimes bracelet.
I wore it every day March, every day.
Oh, that's so
nice. I love it.
I wanted something that connected us, you know, that we, if I saw you somewhere and I saw you wear that bracelet, I'd be like, I know that woman has been through a lot.
And it's wonderful, and it's just, you know, unique, and I love it. So I want to say thank you so much for all of the time that you've given, and we're going to have to say goodbye for now, but tomorrow we'll have a detailed blog and be ready with the embedded podcast, and we'll keep in touch. So good night. Thank you, Karen.
Okay.
Thank you,
Donna.
National audience. You're welcome. See you.